This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Comics and Graphic Novels, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Woke, a host of the channel, and today I'll be talking to Dr. Ezra Santeso about her new book, Muslim Comics and Warscape Witnessing, published by Ohio State University Press in 2023. Dr. Ezra Santeso received her BA from Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, Turkey, and her PhD from the University of Nevada. She is currently associate professor in the Department of English at University of Georgia. She specializes in postcolonial theory and literature with an emphasis on Muslim identity, diasporic and immigrant experiences, and human rights narratives. Her first book, Disorientation, Muslim Identity in Contemporary Anglophone Literature, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2013, investigates the extent to which the questions and theories of postcolonial identity can be applied to Muslim subjects living in the West. She is the co-editor of Islam and Postcolonial Literature, a series by Rutledge, which offers a collection of essays on religion's role in self-representation explored via film, theater, poetry, visual arts, and performance pieces. Essential to the scholarly profile is the fact that she also plays electric bass in a punk band. In the book Muslim Comics and Warscape Witnessing, Dr. Ezra Santeso assesses Muslim comics to illustrate the multifaceted nature of seeing and representing daily lives within and outside of the homeland, focusing on contemporary graphic narratives that are primarily, but not exclusively, from the Middle East. Blockbusters like Marjan Satrapi's Persepolis to more local efforts such as Leila Abdelrazak's Badawi. Santeso explores why the graphic form has become a popular and useful medium for articulating Muslim subjectivities. Further, she shows how Muslim comics bear witness to a range of faith-based positions that complicate discussions of global amma or community, contest monolithic depictions of Muslims, and question the Islamist valorization of the shaheed, the martyr figure, regarded as the ideal religious witness. By presenting varied depictions of everyday lives of Muslims navigating violence and militarization, this book reveals the connections between religious rituals and existence in warscapes and invites us to more deeply consider the nature of witnessing itself. In this interview, Dr. Santeso talks about the origin of the cover art for her book, which is very interesting, the challenges of analyzing warscapes in comics, and the interplay between aesthetics and politics. All right, Dr. Ezra Santeso, thank you so much for joining us today. Ezra, could you start us off by telling us a bit about your background and what led you to write this book?
Hi, Elizabeth. First of all, thank you so much for having me and giving me a chance to talk more about my work. I should perhaps start with a disclaimer and say that I'm not a comic scholar. My training was in English literature. My area of emphasis is postcolonial literature and theory, as you mentioned. And I kind of walked into comics by a total surprise and fluke. And usually I credit my former colleague, Chris Pizzino, for that. Chris was at the University of Georgia, and a few years ago, I went to observe him in one of his classes. He was teaching Persepolis on that day, and my goodness, I could not believe the kinds of things that were happening that was so exciting coming from the Muslim world. And I went home, I read Persepolis that day, and I got really animated talking about it to my husband. And my husband was like, that is your next book project. So I walked into it, not understanding necessarily at first, how does one read comics that is different from reading literature? So for a little while, I really wanted to train myself and understand how to do visual rhetoric, how to do analysis, not just looking at the themes and the interesting ideas, but also positions, placement, vocalization, ocularization. So it was a little bit of a learning curve, but I think I was able to wed the two interests together in the book, and hopefully the readers will be able to get a little bit of both worlds as they read the book.
Great, thank you. And speaking of Persepolis, you open your preface. I love reading the acknowledgments and prefaces in books. Yes. They're so informative. You open your preface by stating that you assign students Margin Satrapi's Persepolis in your course on literature and human rights all the way back in 2015. So it's almost a decade ago. And I wanted to ask you, from your perspective, how has the landscape changed for representation in comics and graphic novels? If you could comment on that.
So one of the interesting things about teaching Persepolis in my class was that, first of all, many of the students came to that class thinking we're going to study human rights through literature only. And for many of them, it was their first time experiencing reading comics. And some of them really wanted to follow up on that. And they were asking me questions about what else can I read from that part of the world? And at first, my answer was quite uninformed. I said, oh, Persepolis is an anomaly. Because, you know, I grew up in Turkey, and even though I had a little bit of a phase growing up reading comics, it wasn't something that was like there wasn't a huge market, there wasn't a huge interest, and I never heard of comics written by Turks or Egyptians or Syrians or anything like that. But then I started second guessing myself and came home and started like researching more. And I realized, oh my goodness, there's like an explosion of comics coming from that part of the world. And they're all talking about really interesting things about human rights violations, autocratic states, gender inequality, social injustice. So for me, I think what has changed between 2015 and 2023 is the visibility of comics written by Muslims or written about Muslims, and the sense of activism that is associated with the graphic form. I mean, I always think about how, for example, Amir and Khalil's book, Zahra's Paradise, started as a webcomic in 2010, and then it was turned into a book in 2011. And then, I mean, many years later, in 2013, when there was another presidential campaign, the protagonist of that book became a virtual candidate for presidency. So to think about that evolution, how the book was read and received, and how that character Zahra became an emblem of oppression and corrupt elections. And she was endorsed by many Iranians living in diaspora as they started like posting their own pictures with a picture of Zahra next to them saying Zahra for president. I think there's like a very interesting link or movement that starts with visibility and ends with activism.
That's a really interesting summary. Thank you. And we'll definitely dive into that a bit more as we get on about the book. So I think it's really important to start by pinning down some terms. And you decided to use the term Muslim comics. I think that's a really important term that you solidified at the beginning of the book. And I was wondering if you could summarize your definition and also the thinking behind your choice here.
Right. So, of course, when one hears the title Muslim comics, the immediate question is it about comics written by Muslims or is it about comics written about Muslims? And I would say it's a little bit of both. However, I was very careful not to limit the definition of Muslim comics to the biography of the creator or the artist. What I was more interested was the kinds of interventionist ways of thinking about the Muslim figure and the Muslim trope, the kind of subversive ways of rethinking Muslim representations in the comic format. That's why I include books written by non-Muslims about Muslim protagonists, because I do think that they're very important in terms of documenting a more accurate and gentle representation of the Muslim everyday life of the Muslims, I should say, and everyday life of the people who are living in distressed areas. So I always go back to Moshe Kaf, who's an Arab-American writer, and she says, well, it's about the, you know, the kind of the biography of the author. No matter how loosely they're attached to the idea of Islam, as long as they're attached to it in a cultural way, in a spiritual way, in a religious way, they should be viewed as like under the umbrella of Muslim writing. And I really wanted to push back on that a little bit and think about, well, can we include things, again, that are subversive and interventionist, but not necessarily written by Muslims, but that are able to talk back against the Muslim trope that we're all familiar with, like the, you know, the yelling jihadi or the radical or the fanatic. And how are they able to bring a new sense of politics of representation in their work? And how are they changing the conversation as a result of that? So that was my take in terms of defining Muslim comics as like this big umbrella under which many different kinds of constituents could meet and merge and provide an interesting dialogue about positionality, about representation, about aesthetics, and how to move the conversation forward so we're not stuck in a narrow, myopic way of thinking about Muslim life.
And a lot of the, so you're speaking about Muslim comics, and in this book, you really focus on Muslim comics in relation to warscapes. So I have to ask, what are some of the challenges of analyzing warscapes in comics? They're visual and kind of brutal from the literary, but also from the humanitarian or geopolitical perspective of things.
Yeah, so I was really interested because, you know, here in the West, going to use Frank Miller's Holy Terror as a big example here, the infamous book. It's always about the Muslim terrorists coming in and inflicting violence on Western subjects, undermining Western democracy, Western civilization and culture, and so forth. And I was interested in Muslims living in distressed geographies, and like the disaffected Muslim and how they are responding to their hostile environment. And in a way, it was a little bit personal to me. You know, I grew up in Turkey, and I had my first coup when I was 5 years old. And it never occurred to me that the kinds of things that we experienced at the time that I thought to be normal, such as like curfews at night, random checks at different kind parts of the city, or crackdowns and like police crackdowns and domestic spaces. So to me, that felt normal. It was only afterwards, like, that I started thinking about, well, actually, that is not necessarily something that everybody experiences, but it is a common way of thinking about how do people react to, like, the traumatic experiences that are in a sustained and prolonged way affecting their interactions and the way they build their communities around them. And that was the guiding principle for this book. And I kind of look back on journalists such as Carol Nordstrom to think about warscape as something that is not a war zone, that is temporary, but a prolonged, sustained, perpetual existence of violence. And one of the things that I was really interested in is how are Muslims reacting to this kind of suffering without necessarily normalizing it? So I think one of the difficult parts of analyzing warscape, as you mentioned, is the type of violence that is being represented and depicted. But I would also add that many of these comics creators and artists are very careful not to turn this into a violence porn or turning violence into a spectacle. So they use different kinds of methods and tactics to be able to remedy that. And I was really interested in that nuance, like, again, like the perpetual suffering without reducing the protagonist into a victim, but being able to talk about their agency, both political agency and personal agency, in productive ways. So Warscape allowed me to think about this kind of the dialectic between the normal and the traumatic, the mundane and the abnormal, atypical everyday life and distress zones.
Are there any examples from the book that stand out in your mind that were representative of this kind of dynamic that you mentioned?
Right. So I can think about Leila Abdel-Razak's Badabi, for example, which follows. It's kind of a the experience. She's inspired by the experiences of her father, who grew up in a Lebanese refugee camp as a Palestinian. And we kind of hear about violence kind of like a third hand. So basically the father sharing his experiences with his daughter, the daughter representing it in the pictorial format. But even the father is not the firsthand kind of the flesh witness of those moments, but gets to hear about them from the community, from the elders. So I always thought maybe, you know, the important thing is to be able to record that kind of violence so we as readers can witness that, you know, as vicariously through these characters. But Abdel-Razak is very interesting in terms of thinking about how to bring the pictorial image to the forefront without using violent details. For example, what she does is she uses space in panel about the father's experiences as a child, but then uses kind of silhouette figures to superimpose into that panel to talk about a different temporality. So you have two different kinds of temporal representations, one real-life father, but then thinking about what had happened in the space before him, and you see these like kind of silhouettes with bullet holes, but no lifelike representations, no realistic representations of the particular kinds of assassinations or murders that have taken place.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
That's such a powerful image. So it's amazing. Comics are amazing. And then a different type of witnessing, you reading these as a scholar, what do you do for yourself as a researcher to get through this type of work? It's difficult to read a large corpus of visceral Warscape images. Or alternatively, how do you prepare yourself or navigate students through visually arresting narratives? For example, one of the books or one of the comics you use in the book is Aaron and Ahmed, which I thought was quite difficult in a lot of ways to look at.
Right. So I always thought about the idea of museums as I was writing this book, which is how do we document suffering without, again, turning it into a spectacle? And one of the very kind of powerful moments that I experienced in my life was going to Auschwitz and to walk through the museum and to kind of hear the narrative of the guide speaking in a very, you know, detached way, but making sure that we would be able to understand the gravity of the experience and the atrocities that were committed over there without kind of hearing it repeated in our heads that we become numb to it. So I was careful to kind of toe the line, being inspired by, you know, what I heard and what I experienced. And I tell my students that as these comics creators creating their testimonies, it is our duty to kind of hear and witness what they're saying and to acknowledge that, to recognize that. And to me, as Charles Taylor says, recognition is an important human rights need. And that recognition, hopefully, will allow the readers to be able to form a sense of solidarity and community that they're able to extend out to to people living in different parts of the globe. So to me, one of the important things that I tell my students as readers is to think about themselves as members of this global community. And how are they viewing the other? How are they seeing the other? How are they looking at historical details and looking at these works that are producing different alternative kinds of history from the margins and kind of challenging themselves with their meta narratives that they heard about this or that, and kind of find a way to form different forms of solidarity with people that they haven't met before or places that they haven't been before, but be able to, again, feel themselves as part of that narrative as it emerges.
Thank you. And in the book, you pose this question, I'm going to quote you directly: how do visual aesthetics and visual politics work in Muslim comics? Could you please say a bit more about your research and findings on the interplay between aesthetics and politics?
Right. So as I said, I was really careful not to look at these works from a thematic point of view only. I was really interested in, like, what do they do visually that is interesting? And I think one example that I always go back to in terms of, like, understanding the aesthetic motivations behind the work is Malik Sajjad's Munnu. And, you know, again, because I'm looking at Warscape, because I'm looking at perpetual suffering, I really didn't want to think about these things as misery literature, but, like, what are they doing visually that kind of allows us to kind of appreciate and, in a weird way, enjoy the reading experience? And I think what Malik Sajjad does is, like, he's very much, he employs German expressionism in his representation. Like Art Spiegelman, he doesn't use human figures when he talks about Kashmiri people living under Indian occupation, but he succumbs to using hunguls, which is a local species of deer in Kashmir, which is also the national emblem of the Kashmiris. So, and he kind of records that suffering by angular angles. And then you always have a sense of, like, Hangul's constantly weeping or constantly looking up into heavens, because he uses that kind of a perspective to make sure that the angles are placed in such a way that it is outwards, so the direction of the reader's gaze is going outwards along with the protagonist or with the characters. So I think that's a very interesting way of kind of thinking about how do you import that kind of experience, but be able to put your own stamp into it in a way that allows the reader to enter into a different kind of a visual space that is different from all of these other tropes that they have seen about the Muslims, as I said, like with Frank Miller and with all the jihadis and the fundamentalists and the radicals that they're part of. So in another example, I think Leila Abdelrazak, when she talks about her father, she makes these, like, intertextual references to Naji Ali's Handala. So there's always that kind of, like, the father Ahmed in very interesting times, like, positioned as, like, a Handala figure, looking onto the space, looking onto the experiences of other people with his back turned to the audience, clasping his hands with his like shabby clothes. So I think that is kind of like an intertextual reference to invoke something that the readers are already familiar with. So I think that kind of warscape existence and identity crisis, the way they record them visually, is kind of a feast for any reader to enjoy, even though the subject matter is dark and heavy and has this like real significant gravitas.
And those are such beautiful comics that you mentioned. So gorgeous. Caught me right on the page.
And I should also add, I should have a shout out to Malik Sajjad, I had the privilege of talking with him as I was drafting this book. And I asked him in a very nonchalant way, like, would you be interested in designing the cover of my book? And I really didn't expect to hear back from him, but he was like, absolutely, like, don't think twice about it. And we had several conversations with him. Like, he really wanted to get to the heart of the book. And he came up with this beautiful design for the cover. And the way he kind of narrated the cover to me was like, he said, well, I feel like witnessing is the key. So he places that key, like literal key, in the middle of this image with an keyhole looking like an eye, which is also very evocative of the evil eye in Islam. And then he placed all these different kinds of symbols and images from like a cornucopia from the books that I talk about in the book. And I could not thank him enough for the care and the unique perspective that he brought into the book.
Oh, thank you so much for adding that. I'm so glad to hear the story behind the cover. It's a gorgeous cover.
Yes.
And to quote you again from the book, you write that, returning to this witnessing, I link witnessing to political and artistic agency, arguing that those who seek to escape this dialectical trap by testifying on behalf of the state can only be characterized as a false witness willing to sacrifice truth for protection. Could you say more about this?
Yes. So I was thinking about how people get to exercise their political agency in public spaces by participating in protests. But in a way, that agency becomes the very cause of their vulnerability, because then they become visible to the tyrannical or autocratic regimes. And, in a way, the moment they step into that public space as protesters, they are being their vulnerability is being exposed. And that starts like this dialectic back and forth between a vulnerability and agency. But I didn't want to build that as a binary necessarily, but as something that coexists. And I was thinking about how they make their grievances be known, even though they're pushing back against surveillance apparatuses or state apparatuses that make them vulnerable in the first place. And I think a good example of that would be Mana Nayastani's An Iranian Metamorphosis. So Mana Nayastani talks about his own incarceration as a cartoonist, and his story becomes a farce that he is not able to face his accusers. He's not able to get a court date. He's not able to get any kind of clarity on the kinds of accusations that he is experiencing. So during his time in prison, he is asked to testify or to come up with tell on his peers, other cartoonists. And that kind of forced testimony forces him to think about himself as like someone who's a traitor, someone who's betraying, but someone who's forced to do so. So he finds himself like participating in these testimonial sessions, but focusing more on the artistic merits of his peers rather than their political orientation. So that is like a subversive way of false witnessing in a way that both suits him, but also allows him to be able to say, well, look, I have cooperated. So that kind of false witnessing is something that is all about self-protection. And we can't find fault with that, right? But at the same time, it is a form of exposure. And he has to be very careful about the kinds of information that he shares. Also understanding that the extent of what he does is going to come back to him and haunt him. So it's a very delicate way of positioning himself, both as a collaborator, but also somebody who's being subversive in that collaboration.
And you write about artistic agency in this context being not only trapped in that warscape, but also being a product of the artist's presence in the warscape. Could you elaborate and maybe give us some examples?
I always thought about warscape as a different kind of a filter through which to see the world. We could think about Joe Sacco's Palestine, for example. I mean, in that particular instance, we have an outsider coming into a warscape and having to learn to navigate his way and think about his sources, think about like what is newsworthy, what needs to be documented. So he's an outsider looking into a conflict zone, and he has a very specific agenda to document. So he has this very journalistic gaze as he's looking on his subjects. And his goal is to inform. Warscape artists, on the other hand, they have a different kind of a vantage point. It's not better. It's not worse. It's just different in the sense that what they do is they're, even though they're testifying about other people, they are very much implicated within that space. So their role is to translate, not only to inform, but to translate and to be able to say, well, here's my culture, here's my people, here's my community. And I'm writing this first and foremost for my own immediate community. I mean, Malik Sajjad makes that point very vividly. He says, I'm writing for Kashmir's first and foremost. But that doesn't mean that he's not aware of the larger global audience. And the moment he is aware of that point, I think he becomes a cultural translator as well, that he's able to reach out to people who have no idea or no experience about the political situation in Kashmir and inform and educate them, as he is also making these like interesting interventions and connections to recruit more people and to bring them into the know and educate them in that way.
Yeah, and it's a recent book, but we all know that the writing process wraps up a bit earlier than the release. So you've explored so many different really gripping ideas as we've been talking, but is there one idea from the book that really stuck with you that you would like to explore more?
So actually, the first chapter that I wrote for this book ended up not being part of this book. So the first chapter was about Muslim feminism, and I was looking at Persepolis and comparing and contrasting that with Özge Samanj's Dare to Disappoint and Dina Mohammed's Kahira. And I was thinking about like, how is Muslim womanhood being complicated in these texts, but at the same time, like just by the dint of writing from a female position, does that make the comic a feminist comic to begin with? And I had my hesitations, even though Satrapi's Persepolis is being described by many scholars as a feminist text. I have my reservations about it because I don't think there are necessary forms of political expressions and community interests in mind. And it doesn't have to. It's certainly talking about a different kind of like positionality and subjecthood that is different and very much implicated in gender, but not necessarily feminist. So I was thinking about, but then what are some of like good feminist Muslim comics? And Dina Mohammed's Kahira was the first thing that came to my mind. And I was kind of like comparing and contrasting them. So I think this is something that I'm interested in pursuing a little bit more. It just didn't fit the book. And I was thinking, rather than trying to force a chapter into it and kind of break the coherence of the argument or the argumentative arc, I should rather, you know, think about this for a future project. So I already started like working on articles about this. But the other idea that I'm drawn in is what I talk about in my conclusion, which is something that I never heard before, that is Muslim futurism. And people right now talk about Muslim futurism as like a futuristic reading of a very religiously dogmatic worldview propagated by radicals and fundamentalists. But I beg to disagree. I think there is really interesting work coming out from South Asia, from North Africa, from the Middle East, that are science fiction works, but very much engaged with questions about faith and religion. They can be dystopian, they can be utopian, but they're really asking questions about what kind of a Muslim futurism can we imagine? And how is that different from radicalism or from like the conversations hijacked by things like Boko Haram and ISIS, which has a very dogmatic and monologic worldview? And I think their responses are extremely intriguing, and they really deviate from this narrative of, jihadism, as many people think is the kind of the formulaic way of thinking about Muslim futurism. So I'm interested in pursuing that idea a little bit more.
Oh, that sounds so exciting. sounds like a very rich line of investigation in there. So on that note, are you working on anything right now that you're excited about? Or is there anything extra on the side or coming up that you're excited about?
To be honest with you, just this morning before our conversation, I've purchased Woman, Life, and Freedom, which is this new comic book coming up. It's Marjan Satrapi is coordinating a group of writers to produce these really wonderful documents of some of the things that are still happening in Iran as part of the protests. So I'm interested in reading and seeing where that book really takes me. But the next book project for me is certainly going to be about polemics in Muslim writing. And I am thinking about, maybe a tentative title will be The Angry Muslim. And I'm going to be thinking about how to push back against this trope a little bit more. And I'm interested in the role of humor. We tend to think that there's no humor in Muslim writing, and I think that is really wrong. And I'm interested in how humor plays a role in the writings of, let's say, Huda Fahmi's comic books, Huda F. Are You, or Huda F. Cares are some of the titles that she's produced, which again toys with that like really humorous, lighthearted, like self-deprecating humor. And I'm interested in like how are other authors engaging with humor and like lighthearted representations of Muslims. And I think that will be part of the next book project for me.
That sounds very exciting. Okay, so we have a lot to look forward to. We'll be following your work as it comes out. And Dr. Azra Santoso, thank you so much for your time today. And it's been a pleasure talking with you.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.